Today we're going to be talking about a brand new study that came out from the Jerusalem Journal of Archaeology related to the time period of the biblical king Hezekiah and his religious reforms and what excavations at Tel Eton in the south of Israel can tell us about this cross-section or this meeting point between the Bible and archaeology. If you haven't liked and subscribed to our channel, please do so. If you like our content, you can also request our magazine, Let the Stone Speak. This is a free magazine that comes out six times per year. It's available to you wherever you are in the world. You just need to go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and on the front page, you'll find a place where you can sign up, or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org. That'll come to me, and we'll make sure we sign you up for your free subscription. I will say the next issue is going to be an interesting one. It just went to press on Friday, and this is the front cover. Is this the Queen of Sheba? And so I'll leave that with you. You can go ahead and sign up to the magazine by going to the website. It's a big feature article on that, as well as introducing you to a new excavation we'll be beginning here in the next few months. In Jerusalem, just 20 or 30 meters from the southern wall of the Temple Mount, excavating one of the last places of this area of ancient Jerusalem that is yet to be touched by an archaeologist. Pretty exciting. So definitely go ahead and sign up to that. This article that I'm about to go through with you is written by Avraham Faust from Bar-Ilan University, excavated from Tel Eton for a number of years. He actually just wrote this book, The Bible's First Kings, Uncovering the Story of Saul, David, and Solomon, Avraham Faust, and Zev Faber. Read through it. Pretty interesting. Agree with, I would say, 90% of it. And there's some points, which is pretty good. And then some points of debate in the end of it. However, he's using one of his main excavation sites is this site in the south of Israel. In this book, he focuses on that and what it has to tell us and the larger picture from the time period of the late 11th, early 10th century, or 10th century. At the same site, though, the preponderance of archaeological remains takes place at the end of the 8th century, which is the time period of King Hezekiah. And King Hezekiah, if you're unfamiliar, just briefly, this is the king that countered or faced up against the Assyrians. He's the king of Judah. The kingdom of Israel in the north went into captivity to the Assyrians in the late 8th century, and then the Assyrian juggernaut came further south and tried to do the same in Judah. It was largely successful in many of the walled cities and towns, but unsuccessful in Jerusalem, or at least did not take Jerusalem. The Bible says this: the army of Sennacherib of 185,000 was put to death at that time, which preserved Jerusalem. And there's so much of this period that's been archaeologically attested. You've got the seal impression of King Hezekiah that was found in Jerusalem back on our excavations with Dr. Elot Mazar, released to the public in 2015, pretty recent. And then you have all the inscriptions that we've talked about in this program in Nineveh and Sennacherib's palace. I think there is over 100 inscriptions from ancient Assyria that mention King Hezekiah. So he's definitely a historical personality. But I think what's so important about this figure is that he is referenced as being one of the greatest, perhaps outside King David, of the kingdom of Judah. And he is a story of coming into power at a young age and then leading a religious revival. Also, some moments where he weakened in faith, of course, as well. And then through the prophet, help from the prophet Isaiah, who overlaps this period, just really did rely eventually on God's deliverance, and that deliverance came according to the Bible. And there's just so much evidence for this period. We have Hezekiah's tunnel in Jerusalem. This article talks more about the religious reforms and the archaeological evidence that we can find for that, particularly from Tel Eton. But this is a largely debated topic based on what happened at other sites around the end of the 8th century during Hezekiah's time, Arad, Beersheba, where you have evidence of religious worship and a lot of that being put out of use, and even at Lachish being vandalized or even just like not just put out of use, but desecrated as well. I'm going to go through this with you. Well written. It's free. It's available for you at JJAR, the website. I'll leave a link for you in the show notes of today's program if you want to go through it yourself. Take some time with it. It reads really well. It reads like a layperson can read it. someone without the background in archaeology, I still think you can get through this pretty well and see where the debate lies. Just the abstract here, it's just kind of interesting. Straight from the beginning, it says, the historicity of Hezekiah's reforms is a hotly debated topic, and as the historical credibility of the biblical texts gradually eroded, so the reliance on archaeological data increased. It's just so interesting to me that this is a heavily debated topic. Just because there is a preponderance of evidence supporting this period, perhaps more than any other biblical figure or period, you have it all. You got the Assyrian documents, you got the Judean writing about this time period. You have archaeological evidence as well. So this is a hotly debated topic, probably because one of the greatest miracles ever in biblical history took place during Hezekiah's time. Sun going back. And then that accompanied the impending saving of Jerusalem, as well as the miraculous healing of Hezekiah. I will mention the Hezekiah bulla, the seal impression that says, belonging to Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, the only seal impression ever discovered in a controlled scientific excavation that bears the name of a biblical king, be it Judah or Israel. It's this one, found in Jerusalem on the Ophel area, just south of the Temple Mount wall. And alongside one that says Isaiah Navi, prophet, which there's disputed. There's people that would debate that, but most likely Isaiah the prophet. You have so much evidence of this figure and these events, and yet it's the most hotly contested. Of course it is. It would be, because you would have to try and if you don't believe in the accuracy of the biblical text, you'll have to take down this story. And you'll have to take down the archaeological evidence or come up with your own reasons of why certain archaeological evidence exists that looks to back up and support the biblical narrative. That's what happens, and that's why it's hotly debated. Let's get into the text here. The historicity of Hezekiah's reforms is a hotly debated topic, and as the historical credibility of the biblical text gradually eroded, so the reliance on archaeological data increased. Drawing on the high-resolution excavations of a large residency at Teliton, this article presents evidence for cult-related or religious-related changes at the site. During the building's first phase, a large standing stone, or matseva, was erected in the largest and one of the innermost rooms of the building. It was positioned so that it was visible to anyone standing at the entrance to the structure in most of the courtyard. At some point towards the end of the 8th century BCE, the standing stone was laid down and concealed within a stone platform that was built around it. This article, reviews the concealment within the broader cultic landscape of the 8th century BCE Judah and its possible association with Hezekiah's reform. The information from Teliton not only provides an additional example of cultic changes in the 8th century BCE, but also underscores a relatively under-researched type of setting, that of domestic cult, which could hold the key to the debate over the religious history of Judah. So what it's saying is there you have state cult or state religion, let's put it that way, get rid of the negative connotations of cult, and then you have what was happening in people's homes, what religious activity was happening in private residencies. Now, this residency is more private, but it's still huge. Like, it's very, very large. They call it perhaps even the governor's residence of this place. And in it, you do have a standing stone, just like you have at some other places, a standing stone at Kibbutz Kayafa, many other places this article goes into. And all of a sudden, at the end of the 8th century, in both the more established religious centers outside of Jerusalem, Arad and Beersheba, and also some other places that have state function, Lachish, gate to that city, and then also at a more private use here, there is a doing away of a religious worship that was done before. And we could just jump over to the Bible. They do this later on in the article, but I do want to reference these couple of verses so that you have that at the top of your mind as we're going through this. This is on page 46 of this article. Just a couple of verses here. This is 2 Kings 18 and verse 4. It says, he removed, Hezekiah did, the high places, smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asherah poles, the groves, he broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. So this is pretty interesting. There was some, of course, his dad was Ahaz, so and he kind of revolutionized religion in the wrong way in Judah, so there was probably lots to happen. But there's even some things that he was doing there where there was religious worship that was at the start, or at least, in referring to this bronze snake, this is the snake that the bronze snake that Moses made, and when there was a plague going through in the wilderness. And so eventually, this going down to Hezekiah's time, this thing that was at once an okay thing to have was treated as an idol, and so it was smashed by Hezekiah. And so sometimes you have these standing stones that at some point might have been okay in the sanctioned religion, and at this point, Hezekiah is, it looks like, in this place and others, doing things for them to make sure that they're not part of the religious worship. Again, another verse here, 2 Kings 18, verse 22. He says, But if you say to me, we are depending on the Lord our God, isn't he the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed? And 2 Chronicles 31, verse 1, says he smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asherah poles. They destroy the high places and the altars throughout Judah, Benjamin, and Ephraim and Manasseh even though those tribes were about to be deported at the time. So that's what the Bible says. The Bible definitely does say that Hezekiah went to town getting rid of the worship, religious worship of items that were previously tolerated. Let's go now and talk about Tel Eton. This is 2.1 in the article. It says, Tel Eton is a large site located in the southeastern part of the Judean Shephelah, which separates the hill country from the lowlands. According to our research, and Faust is the one that led this excavation, the site was occupied in the early Bronze Age, experienced a hiatus, the intermediate, and probably in the Middle Bronze Ages, formed a substantial city during much of the late Bronze Age, contracted to a small settlement in the Iron Age, 12th to 11th centuries, expanded into a sizable city in the Iron 2A, and that's why he talks about this site and relates it to King David, because he's got carbon dates from underneath the floors of this building that date to that time period, expanded into a sizable city in the Iron 2A, and roughly 10th to 8th centuries BCE, according to Mazar's chronology, Amahai Mazar's chronology, and was eventually destroyed by the Assyrian army in the late 8th century BCE. So this is mainly what we're talking about. Going down, it says the late 8th century BCE remains are the most extensively excavated at Tel Eton so far. Usually recovered in a good state of preservation, they include numerous buildings, segments in areas A, B, and D, as well as a few walls and installations area C. Among the major finds from this period, late 8th century, time of Hezekiah, is Building 101, a large longitudinal four-space LFS. This is his his way of talking about the four-room house unearthed at the top of the mound. So four-room houses, we actually have part of an article about that inside the latest edition of Let the Stone Speak, to talk about the distribution of four-room houses in the Sharon area and how that indicates Israelite presence. These are a style of architecture that existed almost exclusively, you could say exclusively, in areas under Israelite control, and they come into being in the Iron One period around 1200 BC, and they continue all the way to 586 when Jerusalem is destroyed. Then after that time, no more four-room houses, or as he puts it, large longitudinal four-space house. Brilliant. Definitely Israelite architecture. Nobody disputes that. You kind of know what the Israelites' houses look like. Very cool. So they have one of these, really large one, 10th century all the way through to the 8th century when this site is destroyed, and that destruction's at the hand of the Assyrians, and they debate whether it's the hands of Sargon or Sennacherib because it happened, they believe, around 711. Very interesting. There is an end note to this paper that is deeply fascinating for anyone that is interested in the competing theories regarding when exactly Hezekiah came into power. Was it more 729, 728 BC, which means Hezekiah would overlap with the destruction, demise of the northern kingdom of Israel, the besiegement of Samaria? Chronicles definitely says this happens. Or is it later on, 715 and so on, which many people believe that as well. And they've got an end note that goes into how the destruction of this site might play into perhaps providing some more evidence for an early Hezekiah rule. Very interesting. So get to that if you're interested in that. But here you've got this building destroyed, 8th century, time of Hezekiah. Most of the remains at the site relate to this time period. Why? This is the destruction of the site. Makes sense that you're going to have most of the remains belonging to the 8th century. Okay, moving on. It says building 101, which is the four-room house, and the excavation of room 101B. Building 101 was excavated over the course of 10 seasons, ending in 2015. It was found in excellent state of preservation. Most of its walls stood at 1 to 1.5 meters high, and hundreds of vessels and artifacts, as well as botanical remains and other finds, were recovered from inside it. All sediments were sifted. All sherds, including body sherds, were registered, and large segments of the building's floors were excavated in a 20 by 20 centimeter grid. Given the high resolution of the excavation and so on, like, this place was excavated well. Doesn't say wet sifting. This was only kind of coming around at the time, so I understand about, but this was a well excavated site. Going down, it says, already in 2006, we realized that below the foundations of a large fortified building, which was later dated to the Persian early Hellenistic period, were excellently preserved iron II remains sealed within a massive late 8th century destruction layer. This means they found the destruction layer during Hezekiah's time at the hands of the Assyrians. We did not need long to understand that the main features in the area, this area, is a sizable LFS house or four-room house. Having estimated its contours, we adjusted our excavation strategy to uncover the house in its entirety. We exposed, documented, and removed the later remains, along with the anticipated contours of the Iron II building, thus allowing us to excavate the structure below. So you'll see some pictures of this. You can easily tell the layout. They're excavating inside the four-room house, and they've got the destruction layer from the 8th century, Hezekiah's time. Very interesting. Now let's get to this part about the standing stone that they found there and the state of it. This was a gradual process. Room 101B in the building's southwestern part was mostly excavated towards the end in the 2014 and 2015 seasons. Only its eastern walls and the area near the entrance were excavated earlier. In 2014, we excavated square 022, which included the southwestern part of the room. Here, below the massive destruction debris from the 8th century, we unearthed a thick and dense layer of small to medium-sized stones, which included one exceptionally large worked stone, carved stone. As the stone layer was quite dense, we initially suspected it was the lower part of the walls, collapsed debris, and thus sought to remove it after recording in order to reach the floor. However, unlike the situation in most other rooms, the floor below the stones was devoid of complete vessels and artifacts. By the end of the season, we lifted all these stones except for the very large one. We considered breaking it, but eventually decided to leave it in its place. In 2015, we excavated the rest of the room, expecting to find the thick stone layer covering the whole floor. However, this was not what we found. The stone layer ended in the northern and eastern bulks. The only exception was the large worked stone adjacent to the huge stone that was left in situ during the 2014 season. So, massive, or not a huge room, small room inside the big building. Excavate half of it in one season, half of it the next season. After they go through the destruction layer, they find this big stone floor. They're starting to remove all these stones from the floor to get underneath it. There's one big stone, half of it, that they're finding. They decide to leave that stone there. Okay, they remove those, come back the next season, dig the other side of the room, go all the way down, no stones. They didn't continue all the way over, apart from this portion of the standing stone, the Matsevar, as they'll go on to explain. Really good job here narrating how the excavation was done in this paper. Moreover, although one, apparently the smaller fragment, shifted, the two parts match in dimension, proportion, and even local indentation. Hence, the two stones are one stone. Anyway, we would like to propose that the Matsuwa and the Standing Stone served as the house's religious focus from the time of its construction until the time it was taken down. Very interesting. So from the time of its construction, it's really early on, perhaps even the 10th century. From the 10th century, we do have Matsuwa found at other sites as well. And yet during Hezekiah's time, right at the end here, this stone is laid down. And there's some pictures of it. They have point number four here. We'll just cover it briefly, saying, well, it basically says that you could see the Matsuwa as soon as you entered the main courtyard through the entrance of the building. You would see this at the end, so it's purposely in a visible location. This is the next page, page 44. The situation at Tel Eton suggests something similar. While the standing stone was cancelled, it was not removed. And there are no signs of intentional defilement. The stone could have been broken into small pieces and thrown away. Although it was not standing anymore, the inhabitants of the house built a platform around it, concealing it and perhaps even preventing people from unintentionally walking on it. If there was an act of desecration, it was minimal and nothing like the one suggested for the Lachish Gate Shrine. It appears that the inhabitants of Building 101 abided by the new religious reforms of Hezekiah, but were not happy to desecrate an element that was the focus of their household worship for so long. Therefore, they therefore dismantled the Matsuwa and incorporated it into the new platform. So, very interesting. And you can read through this it talks briefly about what happened at these three other sites of Beersheba, Arad, and Lachish. In Lachish, you have the situation that inside the gate, you found what the excavators believe, one of the chambers where there was some cultic improper religious worship going on. And so then you have this toilet that is placed, like an ancient toilet made out of stone. We've written about this on the website, placed in this room to desecrate it and never be used. Apparently, the excavators believed that the toilet was just put there but not used. But this was an act of desecration of what was considered wrong religious practice. And they said this is part of Hezekiah's reform. So you have three other sites where there is strong evidence. And most people actually agree with the dating, believe it or not, of this evidence of the destruction or putting it out of use at each of these different sites. And there's obviously a lot of chronological debates going on here. We're not going to get into it. But the broader picture is that we do have, and now we can add Tel Eton to this discussion, that there were changes that took place. One other section here. Why was the Matsuwa dismantled in the first place? And what was this part? And was this part of a known religious reform? To answer this question, we need to date the dismantling. And this is what they say. However, all we can say with certainty is that it took place before the house was destroyed by the Assyrian army in the late 8th century BCE, since the platform was then in use and a cooking pot was found on top of it. But how long before the destruction did the dismantling take place? We cannot at this stage determine. And so this is an argument that comes out, well, Hezekiah didn't actually do anything. What happened was there was this great destruction by the Assyrian Sennacherib all over. And inside that destruction, you also have destroyed religious remains. Therefore, the later biblical authors say, hey, what the Assyrians actually did, that was Hezekiah. And this is coming out and saying, no, there was the religious reform before the destruction. This place was changed, the function of it, the Matsuwa is put down, the courtyard, you have living space on top of it, then destruction. And so it can't be that, at least at Tel Eton and implied through these other sites, that it was not the Assyrians that destroyed the religious that destroyed the religious works at these sites, and that it wasn't co-opted by later Jewish scribes to go and glorify what Hezekiah did. Nope, it was actually done by Hezekiah. And then it says this: who could have been responsible for the dismantling? It is, of course, possible that the dismantling was a local initiative, But since such operations are often associated with religious reforms, we ought to consider this possibility closely. The best known and widely discussed religious reforms of the biblical period are attributed to Hezekiah from this time period and Josiah. We know that. We know that. And so it's far too early for Josiah's time, but it matches with Hezekiah's time. He goes and he disputes with a couple of people that that have written off the previous evidence as being evidence of Hezekiah's reform. Nadav Naaman, one of them. As noted in the introduction, there is yet, so this is not Faust, there is as yet no clear archaeological evidence of cult reforms of the kind expected according to the book of Deuteronomy and implemented according to the histories of Hezekiah and Josiah. Well, not really. Well, sorry, I'll let Faust do this. While the lack of positive evidence does not indicate that they did not occur, scholars must be aware of the fact that the Bible remains our main source of these reforms and that positive evidence has yet to be found. Only when such evidence is discovered will we be able to speak with confidence about the historicity of the cult reforms attributed to Judahite kings in the Book of Kings. Well, you've already got some evidence, and now you've got more. This is what Faust then writes. The priority historians and biblical scholars like Naaman, Alderman, and others assign to the archaeological evidence is justified. However, the negative assessment expressed in the quotes above is problematic, as what is viewed as limited evidence rests on a misunderstanding. We must remember that very few Iron Age II Israelite cultic sites were excavated, but all... So there's not many of them, okay? But where we do find them, where we do find evidence of cultic practice or religious practice in the late 8th century outside Jerusalem, what do we find? But all 8th century cultic sites offer evidence for cult cancellation or at least alteration. Every single one. 4 from 4. While one can argue against this scenario, in individual cases, they cannot be construed as negative evidence. Since, contra Naaman, there is not a single known excavated temple or cultic building that continued uninterruptedly from the 8th century to the 7th century BCE. Hence, the limited evidence does not reflect the lack of evidence, but is indicative of the nature of the cult or religion and the scarcity of temples at that time. So, really great paper. I'm not just saying it's a great paper because it agrees with the biblical text, because that is my bias. However, and Faust, even when he's writing in this book, he's not all in with the biblical text as being inerrant in any way. However, we do have a really good match here for what they found at Teleton, adding to the evidence of a cancellation of something that was deemed okay in prior time to Hezekiah. The Bible says Hezekiah trusted in the Lord as like no king that was before him or after him. And in this case, we see early on in his reign, the Bible does put a religious reform that takes place. And though he would waver in faith as time went on, eventually Jerusalem would be spared by for David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake. As it says repeatedly in 2 Kings, in Chronicles, and in the prophecy, in the book of Isaiah. So here we just have another great bit of a great paper just come out from Israel, detailing something that corresponds really well with the biblical text for the religious reforms of Hezekiah. Thanks very much for being with me today. I'll leave this in the show notes so that you can get to it yourself. Definitely download it. It's worth a read. There's much more in it than I went through, especially this tantalizing endnote about the date of the destruction of this and the possible implications for the date of Hezekiah's reforms. I'll leave that to my friend Christopher Eames to work up an article about that. He's been thinking about this for years, and so I'm sure he'll have something about that in the future. Please subscribe to our channel if you haven't already, and don't forget to request our magazine, Let the Stone Speak. Just go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and go to the front page. You'll find a place to sign up there or write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org. Please put your name and address so that we can follow up with you with that. Thanks also to our generous supporters out there that are supporting the work that we're doing through their donations as well. That's how your subscription is paid. Thanks for being with me, and I'll talk to you next time.